Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, November 30th. It's the last day of November. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local headlines from Fort Dodge. Our first headline today reads, Fire Strikes Downtown. 8 fire departments respond to Webster City blaze. And the dateline is Webster City. A raging fire gutted a downtown Webster City building Wednesday that for 40 years housed Bettis Appliance. Ladder trucks from Webster City, Eagle Grove, and Fort Dodge converged to keep the blaze at 608 2nd Street from spreading to the historic Webster Theater next door. The building that burned is just east of the Webster Theater. The theater filled with smoke almost immediately as the blaze next door raged, and there were worries that it would catch fire. It wasn't until late in the afternoon that firefighters confirmed it had no fire damage. However, Jeff Pingle, president of the board of HERO, Help Entertain and Restore Organization, the group that restored the theater, said the building sustained, quote, pretty serious water damage. He planned to take photos of the interior today in order to assess the extent. The bad news is that this damage hit the theater just days before it was set to host a free movie Saturday during the town's big Christmas in the City celebration. The theater, Pingle said Wednesday evening, is, quote, closed for an extended period. The blaze erupted early in the afternoon and quickly overtook the 5,360-square-foot building that was built in 1900. It is now owned by Jason and Chelsea Watts, according to the Hamilton County property records. According to the building's former owner, Gary Bettis of Webster City, the fire's origin appeared to be in the back apartment on the second floor of the building. Bettis said, this is as he stood at the entrance of the alley that runs behind his former building and watched as flames burst through the roof in that area. The second floor contained 2 apartments, he said. It is not clear if the apartments were occupied at the time the building burned, but there are no reports of injuries. There was scanner traffic indicating that a firefighter may have been injured, but that has not been verified by officials. The fire crept into the second floor of the building to the east of the burning structure. That building houses a resale retail store called Sandy's Attic, located at 606 2nd Street. A cat belonging to a resident who lives in an apartment on the second floor of the Sandy's Attic building was rescued late in the afternoon. The building is owned by Polis Investments, LLC. It was built in 1920, according to Hamilton County property records. Power had to be shut off in the area, which impacted buildings along the south side of 2nd Street. It also meant a 4-way stop had to be implemented at the intersection of 2nd and Superior Streets. Law enforcement blocked off 2nd Street at its intersections with both Wilson Avenue and Des Moines Street. Bystanders stood, cell phones in hand, recording video of the blaze. Overhead, a drone hovered. Fire departments from Duncombe, Stratford, Blairsburg, Stanhope, and Williams also responded. Webster City Police Department, Hamilton County Sheriff's Department, Van Deese Medical Center Ambulance also responded. Multiple city departments were called into action as well. Webster City Mayor John Hawkins watched as firefighters worked to contain the blaze. He said later, I would like to thank our fire department and all the communities that came to our hour of need and the rest of the city departments that helped make a bad situation better. The training and experience meant we had no casualties and major damage contained to one building. The fire was called under control at 4:10 p.m. Our next headline reads, Almost Home Plans for the Future. Matching funds needed for $10,000 grant. The Almost Home Humane Society of North Central Iowa has put up some impressive numbers in its first 40 years. In that time, it has saved more than 17,000 animals, according to Paul Shane, the organization's new executive director. He added that over those decades, 220,000 volunteer hours, an estimated $6 million worth of labor, have been donated to the animal shelter. Shane, who is the first executive director of the agency in about 6 years, is ready to build on that foundation. "I think we have unlimited potential," he said. He has planned a number of activities intended to bring people together with their new four-legged best friends while giving shelter on South 32nd Street, while giving the shelter on South 32nd Street a stable future. Almost Home is now one of just two shelters in Iowa that is partnered with Pets for Patriots, a national group that gets companion animals to veterans. Veterans who get a pet through this program also receive a $150 gift card, discounted veterinary care, savings on pet food and supplies, and a year of post-adoption follow-up, which provides advice on caring for the animal. Shane said the program is new to Iowa. It is currently active, although no one has adopted a pet from Almost Home through it yet. Almost Home recently received a $10,000 grant from the Fort Dodge Community Foundation to purchase a van. Shane said the vehicle is needed for a couple of reasons. "Right now," he said, "there is no way to transport animals. That means volunteers are taking them to veterinarian appointments in their private vehicles." Shane said the animals can't be taken to outreach events so that the public can see them outside of the shelter. Additionally, the van could be used to go to businesses and to collect recycling materials. There is a bin in front of the shelter where people can drop off bottles and cans, which Almost Home redeems, providing a little revenue. If there was a way to go out and pick up recycling items, the shelter could have more revenue, Shane said. But to get the van, Almost Home must raise an additional $10,000 to match the grant. To learn about contributing for the van purchase, call Shane at 515-955-8343. There is another way to support Almost Home that involves vehicles. Shane said vehicles can be donated. He said they will be auctioned off, and the animal shelter will receive 70% of the money. To learn more about that option, visit almosthomeiowa.org and click on Ways to Help. Our next headline reads, "Feeling Festive. Parks and Rec Looking for Businesses to Sign Up for Christmas Tree Walk." Area businesses and clubs are invited to deck the halls at Citizens Central and fill the shelves at the Lord's Cupboard this holiday season. The Fort Dodge Parks, Recreation, and Forestry Department's annual Christmas Tree Walk will be on display at Citizens Central, located at 617 Central Avenue, December 4th through the 20th, for patrons, visitors, events, and programs. For $25, businesses and clubs get an 8-foot-wide spot to place a decorated tree. The fee includes electricity. The tree walk can be viewed during Citizens Central's regular business hours, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, or during special events from 3:30 to 6 p.m. on December 9th, 10th, 16th, and 17th. Admission is a donation of canned goods that will be donated to the Lord's Cupboard. Visitors will have the opportunity to vote for their favorite display in the Christmas Tree Walk, with first, second, and third place prizes being awarded. For more information, contact Program Supervisor Aaron Arndt at 515-576-7237, extension 7205. Our next local news headline reads, "Williams Convicted of Willful Injury for Downtown Fort Dodge Stabbing." A Webster County judge found a Fort Dodge man guilty of willful injury causing serious injury after he was caught on city cameras stabbing another man in downtown Fort Dodge earlier this fall. Donathan Linnell Williams, age 44, was arrested shortly after the September 9th assault and was charged with attempted murder and willful injury causing serious injury. Charges of conspiracy to commit a forcible felony and going armed with intent were added later. According to court documents, the incident was not a random act of violence. City of Fort Dodge cameras and private business cameras in the area of the 700 block of Central Avenue captured the moment when Williams stabbed 47-year-old Douglas A. Foy in the abdomen with a knife at 11:15 p.m. Following the assault, Foy fled to the nearby Coozie's Bar on North 7th Street, where he asked several individuals to call 911. When officers with the Fort Dodge Police Department arrived in the 10 block of North 7th Street, they located Foy with a stab wound. He was then transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center by ambulance before being transferred to a Des Moines Medical Center in critical condition. On November 17th, Williams waived his right to a jury trial and asked that the judge determine his guilt or innocence on the willful injury charge in a trial on the minutes. This means that the judge rules on the case based solely on the minutes of testimony that are attached to the trial information or formal indictment. The minutes of testimony are summaries of what each witness would testify to if called as a witness during trial. In the 5-page written verdict, District Court Judge Angela Doyle found Williams guilty of the crime of willful injury causing serious injury, a Class C forcible felony. In the verdict, Doyle wrote that on September 9th, Williams enlisted the help of Trey Taylor to locate Foy because of an incident between Foy and Williams that had happened the night before. Taylor sent a photo of Foy and his car in downtown Fort Dodge to Williams. City camera footage showed Foy entering the Top Hat Lounge on South 8th Street at 10:49 p.m., and Williams standing across the street from the bar at 11:02 p.m., Doyle wrote. After Foy left the Top Hat Lounge at 11:12 p.m., he started walking north on 8th Street. Williams joined Foy walking 2 minutes later, and a minute after that, the camera showed Williams stabbing Foy. Doyle found Williams guilty of willful injury causing serious injury, enhanced for use of a dangerous weapon after a, quote, full and fair consideration of all evidence presented in the minutes of testimony. She also found that the offense was a forcible felony, meaning Williams would be ineligible to receive a suspended prison sentence. The remaining charges will be dismissed after Williams is sentenced on January 8th. Willful injury causing serious injury is a Class C felony and carries a sentence of up to 10 years in prison. At the time of the crime, Williams was on parole from another stabbing incident that took place in July 2020. And next we have this headline that reads, Humboldt man pleads guilty in federal court. According to a release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa, 37-year-old Joseph Isaiah Hardy Sr., a convicted felon, admitted to being found in possession of a stolen gun and that he had a previous felony conviction. The release does not say when Hardy was in possession of the stolen gun, but state court records indicate he was charged in Humboldt County District Court with theft and possession of a firearm in October 2022. The state charges were later dismissed. Hardy will be sentenced in the U.S. District Court at a later date. He remains in custody of the U.S. Marshal, pending sentencing, and faces a maximum sentence of 15 years in federal prison without parole, a maximum fine of $250,000, a mandatory special assessment of $100, and a term of supervised release of up to 3 years. The case was investigated by the Humboldt Police Department. And now turning to today's obituaries. First, we remember Marlon Spies. Services for Marlon will be at 2 p.m. Tuesday, December 5th at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Pomeroy. Visitation will be at 1 p.m. at the church until service time. Palmer Swank Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Next, we remember Fred J. Filman. Fred J., or Jake as he was known, Filman, age 97, passed away Tuesday, November 28th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge. Funeral services for Jake will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, December 2nd at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Farnhamville, with Pastor Aaron Zimmerman officiating. Burial will be in Dawson Township Cemetery, west of Peyton. The visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 1st at the church. Palmer Funeral Home in Gowrie is in charge of arrangements. Next, we remember Kevin Miller. Kevin L. Miller, age 59, of Manson, passed away November 28th. Loffersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. And that's all the detail we have on Kevin at this time. Next, we remember Donald Sturtevant. Donald Joseph, or Don as he was known, Sturtevant, age 82, of Sioux City, passed away unexpectedly on Saturday, November 25th in Madison, Wisconsin. A funeral mass will be held Saturday, December 2nd at 10:30 a.m. at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. Father Mark Stoll will be officiating. Visitation will be Friday evening from 4:30 to 8 p.m., with a vigil service at 6:30 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Online condolences may be directed to meyerbroschapel.com. And turning to today's news briefs, we have one headline, and it reads, Otho Fire Department Gets State Grant. And the dateline is Otho. The Otho Fire Department received a state grant to help pay for a piece of equipment used to put out grass and brush fires. The State Department of Natural Resources awarded $2,500 through its Fire Assistance Grant Program. Fire Chief Marty Smith said the money will help to pay for a fire skid to be mounted in an off-highway utility vehicle the department plans to obtain in a few months. A fire skid consists of a water tank, small pump, and a reel of hose that is placed in the bed of an off-highway vehicle. The price of the fire skid is $5,000, so the grant will cover half of the cost. And our next headline is of local sports related. It reads, Elevate, Tritons fight off Indian Hills in top 20 class. It is far from perfect for Luke Moffitt, but completing the first half of the dual schedule unbeaten is exactly what he wanted. The number 11 Iowa Central wrestling team dominated 19th-ranked Indian Hills through the early part of the night here Wednesday before holding in for a 25-21 victory inside Hodges Fieldhouse. With the win, the Tritons moved to 3-0 on the year, having also downed North Iowa Area and Iowa Lakes in ICCAC action earlier this month. Trenton Walker kicked off the duel with a 10-7 victory at 125 pounds over Isaac Gibbs, with Jamie Bruner following at 133 with a decision of his own. Ben Fostick brought the crowd to their feet with a fall over Isaiah Perez at 141 in just over 2 minutes to quickly make it 12-0 in favor of the Tritons. Defending national champion Matt Sarbo ranked number one at 149 pounds in the early going, scored a technical fall over Yevian Freeman with six takedowns. Preston Harn followed with a 15-0 technical fall of his own, and Michael Myers pulled out an 11-8 decision at 165 pounds. Indian Hills closed things out with a fall, a technical fall, and a decision over the final four matches as Jaquan East, Darian Thompson, Ansel Cervantes, and Noah Iobe were winners. The Tritons close out the pre-Christmas slate Saturday when they compete in Storm Lake at the Buena Vista Open. After that, they will prepare to defend their national duels title in Oklahoma, January 12th through the 13th. And now turning to this sports headline that reads, area teams headed to state dance competition in Des Moines. And the dateline is Des Moines. The Fort Dodge community will again be well represented at the 48th annual Iowa State Dance Team Association Championships, which run through Friday. Samantha Smith, a junior, made school history last season with her third-place lyrical solo performance. Smith and 2023 Fort Dodge Senior High graduate Reese Peterson became the first two Dodgers ever to finish in the top 10 individually. Smith is back this year, securing another finals berth in the Class 9 dance category. She will perform on Friday in an attempt to repeat or top her efforts of a year ago under the direction of Fort Dodge head coach Emily Eastwood. Smith will be at center stage beginning at 9:51 a.m. Other student athletes in her bracket are Paisley Sutton of Adel ADM, Jordan Green of Dallas Center Grimes, Council Bluffs Lewis Central's Addison Schmidt, Addie Menke of Mason City, North Scott's Caden Strom, Marin Robertson and Peyton Lee, and Norwalk's Elsie Johnson. The Dodger dance team will compete in jazz at 11:59 a.m. on Friday, hip-hop at 2:17 p.m., and POM at 3:50 p.m. Humboldt's McKenna Mathis also advanced to the finals in Class 7 dance. There will be 250 high school teams and 25 college squads in action. Three locations host the competitions: Wells Fargo Arena, Hy-Vee Hall, and the Community Choice Convention Center. Iowa Central, led by head coach and Fort Dodge Senior High graduate Cassidy Vermeer, is the four-time defending community college champion in three major team categories: jazz, POM, and hip-hop. The Tritons will also perform on Friday. The ISDTA state event is the largest of its kind in the nation. Teams and soloists are divided into classes based on enrollment, and performers earn points based on choreography, execution, difficulty, and showmanship. Routines are judged by industry professionals from across the country. The ISDTA was established in 1976. And our final local sports headline today reads, number 2 Triton women edged by number 1 IHCC. Zach Hensley took an approach he has heard before from his former head coach here Wednesday night. Hensley, the leader of the Iowa Central women's wrestling team, saw his second-ranked Tritons fall to number 1 and defending national champion Indian Hills, 32-18 inside Hodges Fieldhouse. An ex-Iowa Central wrestler himself under Luke Moffitt, Hensley was quick to look forward following the defeat. "We want to get them in March at Nationals," he said. "This was a tough night, but I still saw some good things. We got caught out of the gates and got behind early. We'll learn from this and start working towards getting better each day." After dropping the first four matches to the Warriors, the Tritons got on the board with a technical fall from Bronwyn Brenneman at 130 pounds. Former Fort Dodge Senior High state champion Alexis Ross followed with a decision at 136, and Cammy Chance made it three in a row with a technical fall at 143. "Bronwyn proves she is the best in the country," Hensley said. "Alexis continues to grow and is looking better and better every time she steps out there," he said. Indian Hills secured the duel with three consecutive wins after that, before Miranda Bell topped Carla Padilla Zepeda with a fall in the final match. While the Warriors did not use top-ranked 235-pounder Eliana Bomarito, Zepeda is currently number two at the weight. Duchess King ranked number one at 101 pounds. Top second-ranked Emma Lewis with a technical fall to begin the duel for Indian Hills. Javonica Mickens, fifth at 116, moved down to 109. And top number two, Diana Panetta, with a fall, while Shamika Miranda Diaz and second-ranked Angelica Vincente added wins for the Warriors. Brenneman ranked second and third-place finisher at Nationals last year and had no trouble with Amaria Rigner. Ross, who is third, used her experience to hold off Ruth Jimenez. Chance, also rated third, tossed Sarah Lewis, ranked eighth around the mat with several big point moves to quickly put the match away. Iowa Central returns to action December 9th at the NCC Open in Naperville, Illinois. The next home duel is set for January 24th versus Ellsworth. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, November 30th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's headlines for Mason City. Our first Mason City headline today reads, local actor Frank Boyd featured in films streaming this December. Local actor Frank Boyd doesn't claim a lot of screen time in two of his latest projects, but as renowned acting instructor Konstantin Stanislavski famously said, there are no small roles, only small actors. Originally from Plymouth, Boyd, whose real last name is Marino, is in his early 50s and holds down a day job for Chevron Energy in Mason City. He jokes that he got into acting because, quote, I can't golf and I don't fish, so I do this. Boyd is also a bassist and vocalist. In 2017, Kevin Isaacson, a friend of mine, was writing short stories and wanted to turn one of them into a film, said Boyd. He's the one who asked me to be in it, so I blame Kevin for all that's happened since, he said. The 2022 films, When Jack Came Back and Silent Night in Algona, both feature Boyd in supporting speaking roles. I did four or five other films with Kevin, which led me to getting hired through other people. That's how I met Annette Duffy, who produced When Jack Came Back, directed by Thor Moreno, and featuring Boyd in a bit part as a deputy sheriff with a few lines. The plot is about Jack, a washed-up soap star played by Mike Markoff, who has to come back to Iowa to bury his dad, only to find out his mother has some issues, Boyd says, carefully not to spoil too much detail. Jack's mother, Nancy, is in the grips of Alzheimer's disease, and the drama explores themes of life and loss, memory, and family tragedy as the mother and son attempt to find common ground before their time runs out. Audiences can also catch Boyd in Silent Night in Algona, which will be available on Amazon Prime Video stream, rent, or purchase beginning December 1st. The film, which premiered in Algona in December of last year, was directed by Anthony Hornus, who told the Summit Tribune in anticipation of its release that the film is a story of perseverance, survival, family, faith, and hope. Boyd's role in the film is as a German prisoner in an American POW camp. Inspired by actual events, filming took place in Algona and Forest City, with locals rounding out the cast of established actors brought in through the Collective Development Incorporated of Lansing, Michigan, and the Donald R. Teets Charitable Foundation of Algona. Our story is a character study, explained Hornus. It goes inside the varied dynamics of a small Iowa farming community during World War II in an area mirroring the entire country. Times where no one really escapes the turmoil, sacrifice, emotion, pain, and suffering that war always brings with it, he said. Hornus explained further. And when the U.S. Army decides to construct a German POW camp in Algona's midst, bringing in German prisoners, Nazis, the very men who were killing, maiming, and holding captive their sons, brothers, husbands, and friends, not everyone, justifiably, is pleased. It's a story about the people and a moment in their lives during turbulent, uncertain times, small-scale human endurance, and daily life in the face of large-scale global upheaval. These scenarios played out in every community, large and small, in America during World War II, he said. Boyd's work has also taken him behind the camera. His directorial debut, Meeting Michael, an 8-minute short film co-directed with Verlisha Thomas, was featured this September as an entry at the Iowa Independent Film Festival. Boyd also was among the filmmakers and actors celebrated this May at the 32nd Iowa Motion Picture Awards ceremony in Forest City. Boyd said he is currently working on producing an independent serial adaptation of the Batman comic books, where he also plays Commissioner Gordon. That's still got a lot of post-production to do. We don't have a release day yet, but we're excited for what's to come, he said. I have small parts, so it's not like it all hinges on my shoulders, but I had a great time working on these films and got to meet some great people, Boyd said, adding, I just hope that people enjoy the films. And our next local headline reads, Man accused of crowbar assault sentenced to lesser charge. A Mason City man arrested in September for allegedly beating someone with a crowbar has pleaded guilty and been sentenced on a lesser charge. According to court records, 31-year-old Jorge Luis Alvarado Rivera has been convicted of assault with intent to inflict serious injury, an aggravated misdemeanor. He has been sentenced to 80 days in jail and a suspended $855 fine. Rivera originally was charged with willful injury causing bodily injury, a Class C felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. Court papers state Rivera entered the alleged victim's residence with a crowbar in the 600 block of 9th Street Northwest in Mason City around 4:45 a.m. on September 1st. Once inside, he allegedly struck the victim with the crowbar several times, splitting open and breaking their left arm, and also hitting them in the hip and breaking their foot before leaving. And our next headline reads, Local Events, Find Your Fun This Holiday Season. The holiday season is upon us here in North Iowa. Gathering together with friends and neighbors is one of the many traditions we hold. There is a wealth of activities for kids and adults throughout the area. Make your holiday outing plan with this guide to winter fun. And it lists several activities you can partake in this holiday season. The first is the Salvation Army 24th Annual Auction. It'll be held 9 a.m. noon, Saturday, December 2nd, at Music Man Square. Silent auction begins at 9 a.m., and the live auction is at 10:15. The Non-Ensemble Swing Jazz Band will perform at 1 p.m. Saturday, December 2nd at the Principal Pavilion inside Southbridge Mall. Jazzy Christmas tunes from across the decades will be featured. And the Nutcracker is coming to North Iowa at 7 p.m. on Saturday, December 2nd at the North Iowa Community Auditorium. The Minnesota Ballet presents a Christmas classic. Tickets are $35 for adults and $5 for those under 17. Call 641-422-4188 for tickets. And there's also the Mason City Holiday Craft and Vendor Shopping Event at the North Iowa Event Center, which will be held 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. December 2nd and 3rd in the Olson Building at the North Iowa Event Center. 55 crafters and vendors will exhibit, and admission is free with door prizes. And Tuba Christmas will come at 1 p.m. Saturday, December 9th at the Principal Pavilion inside Southbridge Mall. Tuba, sousaphone, euphonium, and baritone players of all ages perform your favorite Christmas songs. There's also the Jingle Mingle Pub Crawl at 6 p.m. Saturday, December 9th in downtown Mason City. This 21 and over pub crawl lets you visit your favorite places in one night. Enjoy drink specials, prizes, and contests at participating locations. And there's the Indoor Winter Farmers Market from noon to 3 p.m. Saturday, December 16th at the Surf Ballroom and Museum. You can enjoy your favorite vendors along with samples and a cash bar. Santa will be visiting the following local festivities. Grab your camera and make your wish list and bring the little ones to see St. Nick himself. So the first of these is Christmas by the Lake. Begins with a tree lighting ceremony that begins at 5:30 p.m. on Friday, December 1st. Saturday events begin at 10:15 with character photos, Santa's house, snacks, petting zoo, and evening fireworks. For full event information, go to clearlakeiowa.com. And there are free photos with Santa at the Cent Credit Union from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday, December 2nd. Love and Luck Photography takes free photos with Santa. Christmas crafts and cookie decorating kits will be available. No pets, please. Pancakes and Pajamas with Santa will be at 5 p.m. Sunday, December 3rd at the Rudd Gym, located at 501 Floyd Street. All-you-can-eat pancakes, sausage, juice, and coffee. 50 cents shopping area for kids to purchase family gifts. And there's the Lake Mills Holiday Festival, which will be from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday, December 9th in Lake Mills. Visit Facebook for a full schedule of events. There's the Merry and Bright Holiday Market at the Square from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, December 9th at Music Man Square. You can shop for holiday gifts and visit Santa in the beautifully decorated square. Snacks with Santas. This is a drop-in event from 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 9th at the Meservey Public Library. Eat a treat, make a craft, and visit with Santa and Mrs. Claus. Breakfast with Santa at the Highland Golf Course will be 9 a.m. Sunday, December 17th. Cost is $5, and pre-registration with Mason City Parks and Recreation is required. Pancake breakfast with surprises from Santa will be available. Registration is online. And the holiday open house will be from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, December 9th at McNider Art Museum. This is a free event and fun for family and friends. Sorry about that. This is a free event for the family with treats, crafts, and a visit from Santa. And then there's Skate with Santa. Finally, from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, December 23rd at the Mason City Arena. Admission is your donation of a non-perishable food item or cash donation for the Hawkeye Harvest Food Bank. Bring your own skates or an extra donation to rent a pair. Our next local headline reads, A Scene, Seen Again. 500 nativity sets on display at Clear Lake Baptist Church. There are many familiar holiday scenes. Snow on evergreen boughs, twinkling lights draped over railings, and of course the ubiquitous nativity scene. The word nativity means a person's birth. These artistic representations are created using figurines of any medium to depict the birth of Jesus Christ. Many include the baby Jesus, his mother Mary, and father Joseph. They can also include three wise men who, according to the Bible, were led to Jesus by the Star of Bethlehem. Even livestock from around the manger can be represented. Amy Reynolds, along with fellow Clear Lake Baptist Church members, has assembled a display of more than 500 nativity scenes from around the world. The church, located at 314 North 6th Street, is holding an open house 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, December 1st, for the public to view the display. To see so many depictions of the same story through the generations and across the world is inspiring, Reynolds said. These different visions of the same story bring us hope. Reynolds and her husband, Jason, who is a pastor, felt called to the ministry after an 11-year stint at the Clear Lake Regular Baptist Camp. The two loved the work and the people they shared their time with, and when the pastor's position opened up, they realized it was a fit for them. We went through a lot of changes in life. There were big challenges. We really made a home for ourselves here in the church, and now we are looking to grow our church family, Reynolds said. Membership has increased in the years the pair have led the church. While the nativity display doesn't account for all of it, Reynolds says the camaraderie between collectors has strengthened their bond. I actually started out the first year, 2016, with basically just my collection of about 200 scenes and anything I could borrow. My friend, Grandma Myrna, attended a church in West Des Moines that had a similar display, she said. Now I have 8 tables of nativities that are just from my collection. There are a number of contributors to the display. Some loan out family collections from years past. Some collect nativities at thrift stores and rummage sales. There is a story behind each one. We were blessed to have mission trips to Israel, Egypt, and Jordan, and I was able to bring back scenes from those places. I do try to find one every time we go on a mission, said Reynolds. The tables of scenes are tidily displayed, with each nativity self-contained. There are antique olive wood displays, ceramics, metal scenes, and even a rubber ducky nativity. We all come from different backgrounds and kinds of families. When you become part of a church family, you know that you're part of a greater group, and the nativity scenes are a reminder of that. The same story, seen through different eyes and experiences, is how we interpret the Bible, Reynolds said. And now turning to today's obituaries for Mason City, first we remember Raymond Dakin. Raymond C. Dakin, age 91, of Mason City, passed away on Sunday, November 26, at the International Order of Odd Fellows home. A funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, December 2nd. At Round Prairie Lutheran Church in Glenville, Minnesota. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. on Friday, December 1st at Major Erickson Funeral Home, located at 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue. Interment will be held in the Round Prairie Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to Trinity Lutheran Church or Prairie Round Lutheran Church. Next, we remember Jennifer Doherty. Jennifer Lynn Welch Doherty passed away unexpectedly and peacefully at home on November 8th. As Jennifer was not one for formalities, no funeral will be held. Instead, a celebration of life will be held December 16th at 2 p.m. at the Front Row, located at 9956 Swanson Boulevard in Clive. Next, we remember Verlaine Swingen. Verlaine M. Swingen, age 89, of Wooden, died Tuesday, November 28th at the Concord Care Center in Garner. Memorial services for Verlaine will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 1st at St. John's Lutheran Church. Interment will be at the Grant Township Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time at the church on Friday. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to 2 letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, Absentee Mother's Prognosis Prompts Different Reactions. They write, Dear Abby, I was married young to my high school sweetheart. We had 5 children together. During that time, I joined the Air Force. After 6 years of marriage, I discovered my wife was cheating on me. Once I realized we couldn't reconcile, I told her I wanted a divorce and custody of the children. She agreed. It cost me my career with the U.S. Air Force. Flash forward to today. 37 years have passed. I have never said a bad word to my children about their mother. My ex never took the time to build meaningful relationships with them. My oldest daughter once tried to have a relationship with her. A month or so later, she asked, Dad, why did you ever marry that woman? I have just learned from my oldest daughter that her mother is dying and has less than 6 months to live. My oldest shared the news with her siblings, who had given up on having a mother years ago. She also offered to drive her mom to appointments. "Do you think it would be good for my children to write letters to their mother, expressing their feelings toward her and giving her forgiveness from their point of view? Their ages range from 38 to 43. They are stable, hardworking adults and great parents as well." And it's signed "Do Right Dad" in Ohio. And Abby responds, "Dear Dad, you are a thoughtful, caring, and forgiving parent. Your children are adults now. You might suggest this to them, but do not pressure them into doing anything with which they are uncomfortable. They may not deeply grieve their mother's passing in light of the fact that she left them behind decades ago." And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, "Devout friend has waited while life has passed by." They write, "Dear Abby, I have a good Christian friend in her 70s who has basically done nothing with her life. Her husband supports her. For 35 years, my friend has been saying, 'God will show me what I should do.' How can I tell her that God helps those who help themselves? She suffers from bouts of severe depression, but will not even choose a hobby because she's waiting on God. Of course, I can't help her to help herself, so I feel at a loss. And it's difficult for me to watch her wait for answers that never come. What advice would you offer?" And it's signed "Frustrated Friend" in Georgia. And Abby replies, "Dear friend, you stated that this woman is a good friend. If you have offered her suggestions about how to utilize her time and they have been ignored, you may find less frustration if you quit doing that. You cannot fix her indecision. However, when she starts cycling down into another depression, you should urge her to discuss it with her doctor. If she says she's waiting for God to tell her to do that because God isn't telling her anything directly, explain that God sometimes speaks to us through the people who love us, of which you are one. Hope it will stir her to action because there is help for those who suffer from depressive illness." And now turning to local sports headlines, we have this one: area teams and athletes to watch on the court this season. The boys' high school basketball gets into full swing in Iowa this week with a full slate of games. Here are 3 teams and 5 athletes to watch in the area. So for the teams to watch, they include West Fork with a 2023 record of 17-5. West Fork has been the mark of consistency in North Iowa high school hoops. The Warhawks have had a younger squad the past 2 seasons, but they are in a position to push for a state berth once again. Cade Eberling and Sage Sunken were excellent last season. Eberling scored 16 points a game, and Sutkin had 15 points per contest, with 6 rebounds and 4 assists. It's not just those two, though. Gavin Kronk and Edison Maskey were 2 quality starters last season and should be great players again this winter. And there are plenty of other impactful upperclassmen off the bench. Expect West Fork to be in the mix for a top of Iowa East championship and a run in the postseason. And Lake Mills, who's 23-1. Lake Mills has been the cream of the crop in Class 1A the last few years. The Bulldogs have lost just 4 games in the past 3 seasons. Last season, they lost in the sub-state final. Lake Mills returns 3 of its top 4 scorers from last year's team that scored 72 points per game, along with other contributors. Lance Helming scored 18 points per game last season. Aiden Stensrud averaged a double-double, and Eli Minke was a great shooter. Logan Bacon was a solid point guard, too. Expect Lake Mills to compete for a state tournament berth again this season. And Osage, who's 18-5. Osage was a solid a season ago, finishing 2nd in the TIC East behind Newman Catholic, and has finished over .500 in each of the last 9 years. Could the Green Devils break through in 2024? They could, with 3 starters back from last season: Quinn Street, Madden Uhlenhop, and Max Knutson. The trio combined for 30 points per game last season, and all are very capable shooters. The offense should be solid again, too, by after scoring 64 points per game a season ago. And the Green Devils could play spoiler come postseason time. And here are the players to watch. Cam Mestis from Charles City. Mestis was a solid player for the Comets last season, averaging 15 points per game with 6 rebounds. He will be the focal point of the offense this year. And Tommy Miller of Forest City, an impactful player on both ends. Miller led the Indians in scoring last season with 13 points per game. He also averaged 5 rebounds, 4 assists, and shot well from 3-point range. Javon Froyland of Central Springs. Froyland was a dynamic scorer for the Panthers last season, scoring almost 18 points per game on 44% shooting with 4 assists. Colby Eskildsen of Northwood, Kensett. Eskildsen was an impact player last season as a sophomore, averaging 15 points with 10 rebounds and 4 assists a contest. And Hunter Hillman of St. Ansgar. Hillman is a big presence in the paint at 6'4", and he played like it. He averaged 14 points, 9 rebounds, and 4 blocks a game last season. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, November 30th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great rest of your November.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.